Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve returns to business matters with Juliet Foster. The war continues to rage in Iran, and with it comes an increasing threat of cyber attacks. Steve shares his thoughts on what the conflict means for cyber investment in the private sector, British critical infrastructure, and the British government's approach to cyber resilience. Steve and Juliet also discuss the UK Financial Minister's spring statement, which didn't include any references to cybersecurity. What does this omission signal? How will multinational companies react? Is cyber a macroeconomic issue? This and more in Steve's latest appearance on Business Matters.
Hello, I'm Juliet Foster, and welcome to Business Matters in conjunction with the European Magazine, a programme first broadcast on Bloomberg TV on the 22nd of March. Earlier this month, the UK Finance Minister Rachel Reeves delivered the spring statement, a macroeconomic snapshot outlining the government's fiscal priorities, spending plans and updated growth projections. But what really stood out was the absence of any reference to cybersecurity investment. That omission comes as the conflict in Iran has sharply increased the risk of cyber spillover into UK organisations, with the National Cybersecurity Centre warning that hostile state-linked actors are actively probing global networks. Well, it raises the question of whether additional funding will have to be allocated to strengthen the cyber resilience of government departments, the importance of which was underscored last year when the Foreign Office was caught in a cyber attack. Well, given the scale of the geopolitical threat environment, did Rachel Reeves miss a trick by leaving cybersecurity out of the spring statement? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Steve Durbin. Steve is CEO of the Information Security Forum, an independent global authority on cyber risk. Steve, it's good to see you. Let's pick up on that point about the cyber spillover. How do you think businesses should interpret that risk? And do you think it actually accelerates the urgency of cyber investment?
I'm not so sure about the urgency of cyber investment. I think that's always been there. I think it's good, though, to re-emphasize the risk. And from a business standpoint, I think what you have to do is very clearly move away from, and this may sound strange to people, but you're moving away from this notion of I have the ability to protect against all threats to a position that says, at some point, something is going to get through. And so I have to become much more resilient in my organization. And that's where the investment needs to move to, because we're starting then to talk about business criticality, business mission. And the big difference for people between protection and resilience is that in protection, you assume that you can stop threats. And so you pour your funding into stopping something. Resilience says, no, something is going to get through. So how do I now create my minimum viable company? What are the sorts of things I need to do to make sure that I can still continue to operate, even though that may be slightly depleted in terms of the way that you can provide service, but you can still operate. So you can still deliver service to your customers. You can still deliver shareholder value. So that's a big shift, I think, that people now need to be looking at, given the sort of situation that you've just described.
Sure, but you should still work on the possibility that something could slip through. There is still that 100% chance.
Oh, absolutely. That's the inevitability of it, Juliet. I mean, something will come through at some point in time. May not be today, it may not be tomorrow. But at some point in time, you will probably have some kind of incident, whether it be a full-blown breach, whether it be something much less serious than that. And so you have to be ready for that. You have to be prepared as to how you're going to respond to that. And very importantly, you have to be rehearsing that on an ongoing basis.
Now look, Iran is in the headlines for obvious reasons, but are there particular sectors in the United Kingdom that are perhaps most exposed to Iranian-linked cyber activity? And how prepared do you think they are for a potential escalation?
I think if you look at what's going on in the region, then the Iranian regime seems to be targeting critical infrastructure. So we've seen attacks on oil fields, for instance, on gas fields, that kind of thing. So if we bring that across into the UK, I would say absolutely critical infrastructure is in the spotlight.
So the energy sector is vulnerable.
Energy sector, absolutely. I would also go so far as to say the financial sector too. Now, what is good, if you like, about both of those is that they are very mature sectors. So they do know how to handle the kind of attacks that we're talking about. They're monitoring them on an ongoing basis. They're sharing that information. They are rehearsing how to respond when a situation arises. But that doesn't mean they can be complacent, because they only need to get through once to cause absolute havoc. And so those are the areas that I think we just need to be focusing on. And certainly that is what's happening at the moment anyway in the UK.
And when you look at the Middle East region, the conflict itself, we're seeing hybrid conflicts being played out. In other words, kinetic and cyber. And it is happening in real time, certainly from a news gatherer's perspective. But this concept itself, the real time, the hybrid nature of it, does that change how governments like the United Kingdom, for example, should actually think about cyber as part of a national resilience package? In other words, you can't just be one dimensional in how you view it. You've got to look at it from the perspective that there are several branches which are being explored to achieve one main goal, to bring down the system, cause as much disruption as possible.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that for most governments, not just the government here in the United Kingdom, I think that's been something of a wake-up call. Because if you remember not so long ago, there was talk about wars having moved from physical to being cyber only. The reality is, as you pointed out, that they are going to be hybrid. And I think that requires a slight change in thinking in terms of how you then defend and how you create a resilient infrastructure, because it's not just good enough to look at it from the physical security standpoint, where it must be said, I think governments traditionally have placed a lot of investment. You have to look at it from the cyber angle as well. And I think that if you look across a lot of the European governments, that's probably an area that they're now focusing much more on. And I would certainly like the UK to be doing the same.
But given that reality, are you at all surprised that cybersecurity wasn't referenced in the spring statement? Because cybersecurity, surely, is part of the national infrastructure. It's everywhere.
Well, you would hope. Was I surprised? I probably wasn't surprised, to be honest. I think that there are so many things when you're putting together a spring statement that, if you like, and call me a bit cynical, if you will, that are much more eye-catching than cyber. Cyber is not eye-catching until something goes badly wrong. And that's the real issue.
As happened last year at the Foreign Office.
Absolutely. Exceptionally embarrassing. You know, should government be spending more time looking into this? They should. Should they be diverting funds away from other projects that they've got, that they're thinking about in the digital sphere, to bolstering cyber resilience? I think they should. Are they? Well, you know, time will tell.
It didn't surprise you that it wasn't mentioned, but does it concern you that it was omitted?
Depends which sector you're looking at. If you're looking at the private sector, it makes very little difference, because private sector will look after itself. It always has done. It always will do, in my opinion. If you're looking at it from the public sector perspective, then I have very real concerns around how secure some of the cyber programs might be that we're thinking about rolling out. I'm referencing things like the NHS, for instance, digital identity. A number of very large-scale programs where we're rushing headlong into a digital environment. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you have to make sure that cybersecurity is going in lockstep with that. And that means you have to invest in it right at the beginning, which means you have to be considering all of the sorts of issues around what happens when it goes wrong, right at the outset, and funding it appropriately. There are no shortcuts that you can take. If you don't invest right at the beginning, it will cost you more in the long run.
Let's stay with the fiscal statement, because look, it wasn't mentioned, cybersecurity, okay, for whatever reason. But more importantly, what signal does that send out, that omission, particularly to companies which are operating very complex supply chains or they're part of the critical infrastructure?
Yes, I think, you see, when we move into that realm, then a lot of those companies really do know what they're doing. And so are they going to pay a huge amount of attention as to what's being said in the spring statement with regard to that? I would suggest probably not, because they have their own plans. They do understand how sophisticated these supply chains might be. And for people to just understand a little bit more about that, we're talking about highly complex networks of suppliers that are truly global.
Third and fourth parties, basically.
And beyond.
Yeah.
And beyond. All around the world. And they present the sort of the soft underbelly, if you like, whether it be hackers, whether it be cyber criminals, whether it be state-sponsored, doesn't really matter. That is the point of entry that they will be looking at in terms of how they can then attack some of the very much larger organizations we're talking about in terms of national infrastructure. Getting a grip on those third parties is not a trivial effort. It requires a lot of diplomacy, a lot of communication, a lot of resource, a lot of money. What I've always said to people is you shouldn't really try to address the full entirety. What you have to do is you have to look at your crown jewels. And back to this minimum viable company notion that I mentioned right at the beginning of our chat, you have to understand what the most critical elements of your business are, and then you can track those through these complex supply chains. Those are the pieces you need to be protecting, because that's what's going to bring your business down or ensure that you can continue to operate. So don't try and do everything. You know, do take it in bite-sized chunks, work through it in a very methodical fashion. It's not a trivial exercise. But that, I think, is how the most successful companies that are out there at the moment are progressing, because they know full well that at some point there will be a degradation of service across their overall network. And they have to make sure that the key components, the crown jewels, are as protected as possible. Mm.
But look, what the current geopolitical situation has done is to really throw a spotlight on the depth of that threat environment. Mm-hmm. Given that, do you think that government departments should expect additional cyber funding, because they will have to step up to the plate in the event of that cyber overspill?
I think they need to certainly be rehearsing for that day. Government departments are funded in a variety of different ways, as you know. Some of them may be adequately funded, some of them may not. I think as a minimum, they should be looking across the whole government estate to see which areas need to be addressed to bring them up to that base level. And benchmarking that. You know, I'm a big fan, again, of benchmarking. You know, how do you compare one department with another? How is the funding being used appropriately? If it's being used really well in one area, let's try and copy that into others. I think those are the sorts of things that need to be going on. That requires a lot better level of communication across different government departments. Probably requires the civil service to step in, and for some government ministers perhaps to step out.
Do you sense that perhaps that the absence of cybersecurity in that spring statement, it is probably going to influence the way that companies with global operations will plan their activities? Yes, they're doing this all the time, but is there a sense that maybe we really have to take it up into the 8th, the 9th, the 10th gear, etc., because there hasn't been that reference? And again, things tend to get referenced when there's a crisis.
No, you're absolutely right. I think if I was an international organization outside of the UK, then certainly I would be looking at what the environment is like within the UK. And I would certainly be asking questions of whether or not sufficient funding has gone into some of these areas from a government standpoint. Would that then impact my investment plans? It may do. It would depend on the sector that I was in. But I would certainly be wanting to take a look across, again, I say some of the other European countries and see how the UK was stacking up. And that may determine then where I put some of my focus from a business standpoint. Because what you don't want to be doing, of course, is putting your business at extra risk. Because we're operating in exceptionally volatile times. And so risk has really moved up the board agenda. And these are the sorts of questions that the boards are now asking.
Yeah, and on the subject of questions, look, cyber shocks, we know now they can be triggered by geopolitical events which are happening thousands of miles away. And my question to you is, does that make cyber resilience a macroeconomic issue rather than a technical one? Are we seeing changes of definitions, interpretations?
I think so. I mean, for a very long time, I've always said that cybersecurity, cyber resilience is not a technical issue at all. It's an entirely business risk issue. All too often, I think we get very excited about some of the technology that's out there. And don't get me wrong, technology has a really important role to play. But so does governance. So do people. And I think we need to be looking at the whole gamut of security when it comes to cyber, and not just getting hung up on the level of investment we've had in just the technology. We need to be spending more, I think, in helping some of our people raise their level of awareness, because again, that can very often be a soft route into an organization. So continued investment in awareness, continued investment in our policies and processes on the governance side of the house, and then of course the technology too. But getting them all to work together is the real key there. And that requires somebody sitting at the top of the organization to be able to take that very much more holistic view.
Let's stay with the economics of this, because When Rachel Reeves delivered that statement in the Commons, you then had the follow-up from the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility. And basically, it's forecasting slower growth and rising unemployment. So it was actually echoing what she had told us earlier.
Yeah.
My question to you is there a danger that organisations could potentially deprioritise cyber investment at a time when the threat landscape is becoming more dangerous because they are responding to these forecasts and this sense of, hey, we're entering a period of slower growth. We have to make tough decisions. Something has to give.
I think, sadly, that is probably the case. I think that the business climate in the UK at the moment is exceptionally tough, exceptionally demanding. I think if you look at some of the legislation that's recently come in, particularly around hiring, retaining employees, the sheer cost of doing business has risen pretty much exponentially for most organisations. And that means that they have to make cuts somewhere. If they can't do it in terms of some of their core business, they will look to some of the fringe elements. So if you've got an organisation that perhaps does not view cyber as being core to what they do, then that may well be somewhere where a cut is made.
That soft underbelly.
Yeah, absolutely right. Businesses have to make those decisions for themselves. I think that government can't go into a business and tell them how to run themselves. What government should be doing is creating an environment that is able to foster growth, because from growth, we see rises in employment. We don't have some of the issues that we're now talking about then arising if you've got a very healthy growth economy. And sadly, that's one of the things that we don't have in the UK at the moment. And that then leads to a range of decision-making at a business level that sometimes will mean cuts where perhaps they shouldn't be.
I mean, look, earlier we talked about the nature of the cyber attacks, how they're evolving, and also the attackers themselves, the approaches which they're using. For example, they're using AI to automate reconnaissance, exploit those vulnerabilities that you've identified, and also upscale the attacks to make them more larger, more toxic perhaps than before. So how prepared are UK organisations for this tactical shift on the part of the hackers themselves?
I mean, this may sound strange, Juliet, but I actually don't see a huge amount of difference. The reason I say that is that, yes, attackers do have access to AI, and certainly they're using them. There's no real evidence that AI is being used other than in creating a better means of attack. So they're not actually going in and using AI to do the attack. But on the defensive side, we have the ability to do the same. And lots of companies have been exploiting advances in artificial intelligence in terms of the systems that they're using. So I'm not entirely certain that AI on its own has changed the playing field, because I think that there has always been this challenge that, you know, attackers only need to get lucky once, whereas on the defensive side, we have to consistently defend 24/7. So I think that AI has brought some differences in the way that the attack and the threat landscape is evolving. But it's also brought some real benefits on the defensive side,
right, too. But there's no change, basically, in terms of the balance between the attackers and the defenders.
I would say not. Not at the moment.
OK. But look, taking it back to the organisations themselves, they are under extraordinary pressure, given what is happening, the landscape in which we're living, and also the landscape of the future. But do you sense that they're perhaps having to increase the build of their own resilience because they realise that they cannot rely on national level protection, that perhaps governments can't keep up because maybe their priority isn't AI and also cyber resilience unless a bad situation happens?
I think that most organisations see that they have a role to play themselves. You know, it's their responsibility. If I'm running a business, then I have to make sure that I'm ticking all of the appropriate boxes. And one of the key boxes I want to tick is, am I still going to be in business tomorrow, irrespective of what hits me? So it then becomes a question of what is the role of government in that? And I think that in the UK, we've certainly seen the NCSC step up their activity in terms of recommending things that small to mid-sized businesses should be doing at very, very low cost. And I think that's absolutely
right. But that's a dissemination of advice. What about structures that complement what the companies themselves are doing?
I'm not entirely certain at the moment that the government in the UK can do very much with regard to that. I think that the onus is fairly and squarely on large businesses to look out for themselves and to collaborate, which happens all the time. Let's not forget that. If we're talking about the energy sector, high level of collaboration there, if we're talking about
but
the
finance.
But
you could argue
sector.
That energy, finance, that's obvious, isn't it? Because they're so central. They're a major part of the spine of this country.
They are. But I think we have to question the role of government. And I would say that the role of government is not to make sure that, you know, businesses are making the right decisions. The role of government is to provide the environment which makes it easier for them to make those sorts of decisions. I don't think anybody wants a government to roll in and start telling us how we need to be protecting
sure,
our assets.
Because then that goes into the area of overreach, which
absolutely.
A lot of companies...
So it's a balance that, that they have to get absolutely right. What we must expect, though, is for government to be protecting government resources.
Yeah, and no one's going to argue with that, but at the same time, isn't there also a state of mind at play here that governments perhaps still see cyber issues as technical rather than technical issues that have grave economic consequences for the companies themselves who are doing their very best for citizens and also for reputations of governments because of what is attacked and the fallout from that?
I think so. You know, my hope is that things are changing. The world is changing. Governments traditionally tend to move fairly slowly. And so I think we have to take that into account. However, in times of war, in times of challenge, such as we've been talking about, you would hope that they would be stepping that up and accelerating that in key areas. So again, it's about perhaps rechanneling funding from some areas into those that are actually going to make a difference in terms of bolstering national resilience.
Which is a tough decision as well, who goes without and who receives. But look, in the past on Business Matters, you said that organisations need to rehearse for disruption. Mm-hmm. You've explained how they should do this. Obviously, the frequency, that depends on the company and the area that it's involved in. But given what is happening now and the uncertainty, because we don't know how the geopolitics is going to play out on this, do you think we have now reached a stage where we're moving from rehearsal to active response?
I think that most organisations that I talk to are reviewing at the moment their response. Some of them are actually playing that out in the form of simulation exercises, whether involving boards right the way down to people on the sharp end. So I think that a lot of that activity is going on at the moment. It's shone a light on it, what's going on in the Gulf, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think that for a lot of organisations, they were beginning to move down that road anyway. I think it's the NCSC again recommends that you do that sort of thing at least once a year. Mm. I would go further than that. I think it depends very much on which sector you happen to be operating in and where in the world you're operating. You may be doing it every 6 months. I would see once a year as being an absolute bare minimum for people to be doing it.
Let's go back to that Foreign Office breach. It happened in October 2025. Mm. And apart from the fact it was very embarrassing, what it also revealed is that even well-resourced departments like the FO are vulnerable. But from your perspective as an expert, somebody who has to look at the landscape, what did that breach tell you about the state of government cyber resilience? And what are the biggest gaps? Are we talking about financial, structural, or perhaps skills-based? What was your take?
My take was that this was an example of protection as opposed to resilience. So I think what people had been trying to do was to protect the asset, really looking and to see where the threats might be coming from, assuming that you could prevent an attack taking place, as opposed to a resilience-based approach that says, now let's play out how we're going to respond and what happens when we're attacked. And let's put resources into dealing with that so that when it happens, when the day comes, and it will for everybody, we know how we're going to respond to that. And I feel sympathy for any organisation that has been hacked or had some form of a breach. It's a dreadful experience to go through. But if you happen to be a government department...
It's embarrassing.
You have to be prepared for the fact that the spotlight is really going to be shining on you. The press are going to be asking all sorts of questions. And it moves very rapidly into a political environment as opposed to just being any other breach that happens to organisations. And so playing that out, playing those responses out, looking at whether or not you've got the right resources in place, whether that be technological, whether it be people, whether it be funding. But I think being very realistic about the impact is something that, in this instance, perhaps they were found a little bit wanting.
Yeah, but also talking to the large companies as well, because they're putting the emphasis on resilience, and maybe there's something to learn from them. They're actually ahead of the government in that sense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But look, we've had major commitments over the past 18 months around this area. I'm going to cite, for example, the £210 million public sector cyber boost. There's also the cybersecurity resilience bill. So nobody is being indolent. But these were not reaffirmed in the spring statement. But would public bodies be correct in assuming that funding, that commitment, along with the momentum, remain intact, even if they weren't referenced in the Commons?
Well, I think that's probably a question for government rather than for me. I think that...
But you would certainly hope that that money stays intact.
You would hope. You would hope.
These public sector breaches, there are all sorts of reasons why they happen, but could it also be down to outdated systems, supply chain weaknesses, or perhaps are the explanations a bit more esoteric?
I think one of the things you always do once you've been attacked is you really throw yourself into the forensics to try to understand what happens. There's no doubt that with the sorts of large-scale organisations we're talking about, there is a plethora of legacy systems. Mm. Legacy systems are traditionally very difficult to protect, particularly as they are interfacing with much more modern systems. There's no easy answer to that. You simply have to methodically go through, look at all of the different vulnerabilities in each of those different areas. And I think that is one of the big challenges that all organisations face. The banks in particular are vulnerable in that area because they have to deal with so many legacy systems because they've built systems on top of each other. And government is no different when we look at it from that perspective. I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying that there is a very large challenge. And that means that you have to be prepared to face that challenge. And this is the whole key behind the resilience versus the protection piece. Because resilience means that you have to have dug into that. You have to have understood what happens if you have an attack that impacts your systems. And I think that that is something that people are moving towards very much more today. Some organisations are a little bit slower than others to get there.
We don't know what the cyber legacy will be of the current geopolitical picture, but what I want you to do is to project ahead, not just to 2027, but also to 2028. If you and I are still talking, what do you think you'll be telling me are the biggest cyber threats to UK organisations?
I think some of them, sadly, will be the same, because I don't think we're going to be able to solve some of the problems. They are perpetual problems. So I would say supply chain is still going to be there. I don't think that's going to go away at any point in time.
Because they're constantly mutating, changing all the way.
Exactly. And we operate in a global environment where we are consistently, you know, sharing information the way around the world. So I think that's one of the ones that's still going to be there that we'll be talking about in 2028. And probably 2029 as well, if we're still doing this. Mm. So that's one of them. I think inevitably we will have got more information on how AI is being used on both sides, attacker and defender. I don't think that one's going to go away. And I think another one we will be talking about still is the role that people have to play in all of this. My hope would be that by the time we get to 2028, we will have done more to realise that the absolutely fundamental and critical role that people play in not just preventing some of these attacks happening, but in responding to them as well.
Do you think that we'll be a bit more optimistic about things on the resilience front? Because it does seem to me as if the picture there is a little bit patchy, that some companies perhaps are better at understanding the importance of resilience than others. And maybe for the ones who have a very superficial notion about it, they feel comfortable because they haven't been attacked. So perhaps it breeds an element of complacency.
I think we'll certainly see a maturing of the industry. It's a very young industry still in terms of the way that it's evolving and changing. And I think that with the benefit of a couple of years under our belt, then most organisations will have moved to a stronger position from a maturity standpoint. And I would hope certainly that we're talking very much more about resilience rather than protection.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there because sadly we've run out of time. But Steve Durbin, Chief Executive of the Information Security Forum, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Juliet Foster and you've been watching Business Matters in conjunction with the European Magazine, a programme first broadcast on Bloomberg TV on the 22nd of March.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.